Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with my guest, Nicholas Carlo, web developer at BusBud. Nicholas, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I know about you as the guy who writes about legacy code, which is a topic that I'm also interested in, and we're going to talk about that today, but first, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm French. I moved to Montreal, Canada 2 years ago. I'm a web developer at a startup named BusBud. So that's what I do on a daily basis. And then on the side, I also co-organize the Software Crafters Montreal Meetup, which is a very nice community. And I do have a weird passion for legacy code. So I'm blogging on understandlegacycode.com every week. I share tips and advice on that.
And just curious, how long have you been running your meetup group?
When I was in Paris, there was a meetup already, like since 2011. But when I moved to Montreal 2 years ago, there was no community. So in September 2018, I decided to just create one. And since, so it's almost 2 years, a year and a half, we have been doing monthly meetups. And the community have been growing steadily. I know it's a very nice community, nice meetup. So I'm looking forward to meeting them again. Obviously, we don't meet these days, but yeah, it's really nice.
Yeah, like how many people come to a meetup on average?
These days, around 35 people, I would say. A regular evening, it's 35. And some we do have special meetups with special guests when they're in town, like Joseph, G.B. Rainsberger, for example, he came. And Gleb Bamutov also, the VP of Cypress, VP of Engineering of Cypress. So in these special events, we have more like 50 people coming.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I recognize some of those names. I've run a couple meetups myself. I did a JavaScript-focused meetup. I did just a general web development meetup because the city I live in, or the city I live near, is small enough that it makes sense to have like a meetup that's just all web development together. And I would highly encourage anybody listening, if they've ever thought of doing that, just dive in and try it, because it's pretty rewarding in my experience to do that. And people will show up if you start it, or maybe they won't and you can kill it, but you know, not much harm in trying. Has it been an enjoyable experience, I assume, since you've been doing it for so many years?
Oh yeah, sure. And the reason you do that is to meet new people. I've met a lot of different developers from outside of my company, and that was really interesting. And I've met some, not friends necessarily, but good contacts of people who come over and over, and it's refreshing to talk with them. And also, yes, when I started this meetup, for example, the first sessions we were like 4, 5, 6, but still, as long as you got a place and people coming, it will progressively grow with time. So, yeah, just do it. It will be an advice I give to you.
Yeah, it's a great career move too, because it really like elevates your status in the local development community. And like you said, you can form a lot of new business business connections, but maybe, just like connections that can help you in your career over the years.
Yeah, in general, meeting new people, and sure, when you meet new people, you learn new things, new opportunities eventually for you if you want to move to another place. Actually, when I was in Paris, I found my former employer like that, because I met so many people from that company in meetups I was going at. So yeah, that's how I get into that company. So yes, definitely professionally can help you. And personally, it's always fun to go there, connect, chat with people, and sometimes well, almost every time you learn a few things, like new libraries, new techniques you didn't know. So.
Yeah, totally a great idea. Highly recommend it. Okay, now to transition into our main topic of legacy code. You and I were talking pre-show about that book by Michael Feathers, Working Effectively with Legacy Code. I'll ask you about your experience in just a second, but my personal experience has involved a lot of legacy code in my development career. In fact, the vast majority of the code I've worked with has been legacy code. And I've worked at a lot of different jobs. I've been a job hopper for a long time. I would only work at a job for like a year or even a number of months before I would switch to a different job. And then I went into freelancing because I realized that, like, wait a second, jobs aren't a great fit for me, apparently. But now I actually have a job that I've had for kind of a long time. But anyway, I've worked at like 35 different places, if you can believe it. And the vast majority of the code bases I've worked on were really bad. And I always find it funny when somebody who's like early on in their career, they get one of their first jobs and they're like super surprised that the code is low quality. And I'm like, bro, get used to it. This is like what it's like.
Yeah, that's true. We're not prepared for that because I remember when you study either at university or by yourself, you create code from scratch, which is fine because you're learning it, but you don't really practice working with existing code at all. And as you said, most of the code you will be working on is existing code. If you're working for a company or doing consulting or maybe even freelancing, you will also work with code that you didn't wrote in the first place, so completely new code. And it's frequent also that the people who wrote the code are not here anymore. So yeah, it's an actual challenge, but it's also part of the job. And for example, at BuzzBud, when I interview for a senior position, senior developers, now what I'm looking for is someone who is able, for example, to write tests on existing code that is not tested, because I realize this is a precious skill that is not so common, and someone who is able to do that, usually it's a sign of seniority, maturity, and
Yeah,
not
and I think
experience.
we just hit on the perfect topic for you and I to talk about because that's something that I've thought about a lot in the past, and I've spoken about that in the past, and I have some thoughts on that. In your mind, okay, so there's a piece of advice that I hear sometimes, which is like, if the project doesn't have any tests, just start adding some tests. Just go for it. What do you think about that advice?
Well, this also aligns with Michael Feather's definition of legacy code. So the book you mentioned before, the very popular definition of legacy code is any code without test. It's not, I don't completely agree. Like, to me, it's not my definition of legacy code, but I think it's a valid one and a very useful one, because in my experience, most of the code is lacking tests in general. And tests are important because you want to have tests so you don't test it manually. You have automated feedback. And that feedback is valuable to tell you when something breaks, so you don't discover it with manual test, or usually you don't manual test everything. So the person who will do the manual test for you is the end user, your consumer, your visitor. And if they found a bug, well, in production, that's terrible. So you do test because you want to learn about bugs before they hit production. and you want to do that fast.
Yeah, I think of it like this. It's like everything you write gets tested eventually by somebody. It's just a matter of at what stage does it get fixed. It can get caught really early by an automated test, or it can get caught a little ways down the road by you manually pokering around in the browser or something like that. Or your boss could find the bug. And that's a little bit worse. And then you could get even further and like your end client could find the bug or something like that. And that's a little bit worse. And then worst of all, the end user could discover the bug. And that's how the bug is discovered. And obviously, it gets more and more expensive and embarrassing and all that stuff as you go down.
Yeah, exactly. Expensive. So that's why you want to have the fastest feedback you can about that. So yes, if your code base has absolutely no test, it's in general a good idea to start adding some tests as a practice. So I would agree that if I have to work on a new code base with the team and there is absolutely no test, I will start to look at this. How can we add some tests on this code base? And then comes the question of where should you start?
Yeah, because what I was getting at with that advice of like, oh, just start adding some tests, is that it's not really that easy, right? Because if the project doesn't have any tests, there's probably some reasons that it doesn't have any tests. The worst reason can be that the team and the leadership is actively anti-testing. And that's the toughest situation, because then if you try to add tests or you try to advocate for writing tests, you're going to get actual resistance and you might be not allowed to write tests explicitly. Like, that's the worst situation. So it's not easy in that case. Or a better case, obviously, is everybody wants to write tests, but maybe they don't have the skills or they inherited the project from somebody else or whatever. But the problem with that is that you can't just like one developer on the team can't just start adding tests because, well, the testing infrastructure isn't there. You don't have a plan as a team for how you're going to approach testing. Have you encountered this challenge before of like, you know, you can't just as one person just start randomly adding tests, right?
Yeah, sure. That's true in general. I actually encountered that a lot, not personally, because I was always lucky to get the team on board on all of my previous experiences. But at the Software Crafters Meetup, for example, you sometimes have someone who come and they say, you know, my team, they don't do clean code, they don't refactor, so I spend my whole time refactoring their code and they take it badly. I'm in trouble with them, etc. And we try to explain to that person that he misses the point, because team consensus and team standards trumps your individual, for example, code style or thinking. So first thing, yes, is to agree on what to do with the team, because you work as a team, you don't work alone. So if you are the only one to decide, I'm going to refactor this whole code base, I'm going to add some tests, etc., but the rest of the team is not aligned with you, that won't be efficient. And in general, we will speak about technical details and technical ways to solve the issues. But the first thing to do is usually a people problem to address. Talk to people, get people on board, discuss what you want to achieve as a team, and then present solutions on how you get there.
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% agree with you that it's a people problem first. You mentioned that you've been able to get your teammates on board in the past when you've had that challenge, and you've kind of answered this question already, but how did you go about that? Like, how did you get people on board? Were they already like sold on it and it was just a matter of figuring out the details, or did you have to do some persuading?
It depends. So when I was consultant, it was easy because usually I was like paid to bring that. So the team was already looking for someone to guide them there. But when I joined BuzzBud, for example, I was hired as a regular developer among a team of other existing developers. So I didn't have an authority when I came 2 years ago. But it became clear with time, with the bugs that happen in production and things like that. We did retrospective about that, like postmortems, for example, about like the most hurting bugs and how can we prevent that. And if you go down that path thinking, how could we have prevented that? And every single time, maybe not every single time, but most of the time, one of the answer is, well, if we did add a test on this specific part, we would have caught that way before. After some time, the team is not is not persuaded by your arguments, but they are actually convinced because data adds up. And you mentioned, for example, the kind of culture where the tech lead, for example, say he doesn't want to attest, he is against that. I don't think that person is really against test. I think that person is against an idea of what testing looks like, costs, and worth. And in his experience, test costs a lot, probably to maintain, to write and to maintain, compared to the value that person got from the test. But obviously, it's not supposed to be like that. We're doing tests because it saves us time. So the only thing is, you also said it, people maybe lack the skills of writing proper tests, but they all want to save time.
I just want to interrupt and say that I
Go
have
ahead.
two things to add about that. I mean, it's true. Some people are just really fucking stupid and they are against tests and they think it's a bad idea. It's insane, but those people do exist and somehow they end up as people's bosses. It's absolutely crazy. But I think you're totally right about the misconception that tests are like this extra thing that costs extra time and maintenance and all that kind of stuff. It's not extra because it saves more effort than it costs. And so it's not an extra thing. It's just part of the process, and you end up net better off for it, right?
Yeah, but it takes practice because it's totally possible to write bad tests, I would say, like tests that actually cost more to maintain than they provide value. So that's where I have I think there is a limit in the legacy code is code without test to me, because I have seen code that was tested, but I considered this code to be a legacy because the tests were not good enough and not useful, and they were wasting our time.
Oh, tell me about that. I don't know if I've experienced that too much myself, so I'm curious about that.
Sure. I have the first example that came to mind is the kind of snapshot test. So that's very popular in the React community with Jeff, for example. It's also called approval test or characterization test. Different names, but the same concept. Like you write the code first, and then you just capture the outputs. You put that you take the output. You write that in a file, for example, and every time you run the test, it will check that the behavior of the code is still the same than the snapshot. The problem with this test is that whenever you do change the behavior, the test will fail because it will tell you the behavior has changed. So it fails, but it fails for valid reasons. So what you do is you update the test when they fail. And it's very, very frequent in my experience that people stop listening to failing tests. And whenever the snapshot fails, they just update the test. And in the end, the value of this test is very low because anytime someone changes anything, there will be test failing. They won't listen, like they won't look at the diff to see if there is an actual like bug or not, and they will just update that. So this is an example of the test doesn't provide you value anymore, and it's wasting your time by sending you false signals, and you don't listen to the signals anymore because they are flaky, so to speak.
Yeah, I can see how that would be really bad. And the solution to that, of course, is to make your tests more loosely coupled from your behavior. You want to test the behavior of your application as opposed to the implementation of your application, right?
Yeah, that's the typical kind of test that is also not providing value. And I think it's the main challenge for everyone starting to write tests is not to test the implementation, as you said. It's very easy to go and test the implementation. And when you do so, when your test is too coupled to your implementation, you can feel it's painful to maintain the test because every time you change anything, you have a bunch of tests failing again, and they fail for no good reason. But the reason is that you're testing the implementation in all of your tests, and you should not. You should test, as you said, you should test your behavior. So if you want to change the behavior, it is legit that one or two tests will be impacted because this is the behavior you are changing. But that makes sense. But yeah, if they just fail because of some implementation details, then they're telling you that you have a problem with your test. And there are techniques to improve that.
Yeah. I had something brilliant to add to that, Nicholas, but I forgot what it was. So hopefully I remember it later. I remember what I was going to say. I've heard those kind of tests that are like really, really tightly coupled to the code. I've heard those referred to as tautological tests. These tests are basically just a restatement of the code. You're basically just writing the same code twice. And similar to those snapshot tests that you described, if you change any little detail in the code, it's going to make the test fail, and you'll just have to update the test to reflect that change, and it's completely valueless. It's more valuable to test for check for the actual end result of the thing that happens, so that if you change your code to accomplish it in a slightly different way, the test still passes because it really still does the same thing.
Yeah. And that's not easy to do, definitely, because you need to combine that with the fact that you also want your test to be fast and reliable. And the moment you start adding database connection, HTTP calls, the system, and things like that, it makes your test slow and less reliable. So you got, this test failing because the network was down or something like that. So you want to reduce that kind of test and have a maximum of reliable, super fast tests. So they are valuable. But how do you combine that characteristic with not depending on the implementation details? And these two constraints of what is a good test is guiding you in a good direction, in my opinion, but it's not easy to do. It takes practice and experience. So I will encourage people to just practice this. If they want to do testing that is actually valuable and helpful, and stop seeing testing as a waste of time and not worth the cost.
So there's something else I want to ask you about, Nicholas, which is adding tests to existing code can be difficult sometimes because the code is written in such a way that makes it hard to add tests to it. And I'm talking about a little bit of a different thing than we were talking about earlier, because it might sound similar. But for example, you might want to add some tests to a class, but it's really difficult to instantiate that class in a test because that class depends on three other classes, which in turn depend on other classes themselves and so on. Have you ever encountered that kind of situation?
Yes, that's the most common situation when you start adding tests on existing code. The code was not tested before, and so this kind of issues didn't raise up probably before, so it's very likely you are in this situation. in the end, if you go down the dependency hell and you find what is actually problematic, most of the time it's, again, a database, an HTTP call, something depending on the system, that kind of thing, or a shared reference like a singleton or a global variable. But usually these are not preventing your test to set up. The thing preventing you from instantiating your first test is usually some kind of infrastructure put around your system. So yes, the first test is the most challenging. When you manage to get your first test, you are in a good position.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because there's like all this foundational work that's often necessary in order to get your first test in place. And I assume it's like, so you work mostly with JavaScript technologies, is that right?
Yeah, these days, yes.
Yeah, it might be different between JavaScript technologies and Ruby on Rails projects, because with Rails, the Ruby code at least is auto-loaded, and so everything's available all the time. And so there's less of those infrastructure challenges, but it's still definitely true that there's a lot of foundational stuff that needs to happen before you can even write your first test. And that's why I usually recommend that if your project doesn't have any tests, your instinct might be one of a number of things. Your instinct might be to try to test what's most valuable first, but I advise against that, because it's likely that what's most valuable in your application is also among the most complicated code, and that's going to be the most difficult to test. So I would suggest starting with what's most trivial instead, because then you can establish a beachhead and get that first test written with relative ease, and then expand incrementally from there. Another piece of advice I've heard is, like, anytime there's a bug, write a test that covers that bug, which sounds like good advice, and maybe in some scenarios it could be good advice, but I think a lot of times it might not be good advice, because it's unlikely that those scenarios where those bugs pop up also happen to be the places where tests are easy to add. And so that might be tough. You might encounter a bug that takes 5 minutes to fix, and then to write a test for it would take 2 days. And that would just be unacceptable at that point in the project. So again, I would start with what's easiest rather than what's most valuable, or doing the kind of clean as you go kind of thing. Do you have any thoughts on that kind of approach?
No, that's I've heard the same advice. Usually, I think they're good, but as you said, they have pitfalls when you go in like concrete real life at work with deadlines and with things you need to ship. You cannot just take 2 days to add the test before you do the fix. In that kind of situation, I take a pragmatic approach. So I will do the hotfix, the 5 minute hotfix, and ship that to stop the fire, for example. The question obviously will be, how can you prove that you actually fixed the bug? Because you still need to prove that. It happened that if you don't do it, you actually create two other bugs when you ship your fix. So be careful about that. But yeah, ship your fix and then plan to add the test later. Well, that will be interesting to do a postmortem and to see how could you have caught that with a test. And if it's hard to write the test, why, can be interesting to investigate. I also like to, when you have to deal with existing code and you need to change it, say, for example, that adding the test is not easy, it's not trivial, but if you don't add the test, how do you know that you didn't break the existing behavior? That can be challenging.
Yeah, and that's a real challenge, because you have to have like a decent level of overall test coverage on the application to have confidence that you didn't break anything. You can never prove that you didn't break anything, even if you have 100% test coverage.
That's true.
Yeah, you just can't prove the absence of bugs. So it's not like a yes-no thing. It's more like a low-confidence, high-confidence type thing. But that's really tough, because even if you add a test for a bug that you just fixed, you can't prove that in fixing that bug, you didn't introduce a bug somewhere else unless you have some pretty good test coverage on the whole application.
Yeah, that's true. If you really have absolutely no test, it could be a good idea to at least secure the critical scenarios with a very high level test, like end-to-end test. So if you're doing a web application, Cypress is doing a good job today to provide you with that. We do have that, for example, at BuzzPub, the main payment flow. We do have a few tests, not too much, because this kind of test can, you know, they take some time and things like that. You don't want to test everything with that, but still on the critical path, we want to know if we break something. That's kind of our safeguard. The return on investment, it's actually good. It's not too hard to write such tests with the tooling we have today. And the impact of having a bug here will be enormous. So that's why it's worth it.
Yeah.
So I will start with that. If there is absolutely no test, I will start with that. So I have at least a safety net that allows me to do more risky changes to make the code testable.
Safety net that allows you to do more risky changes to... Oh, yeah, okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, because a lot of times you don't want to change... This is from the Michael Feathers book. You don't want to change the code until you have a test for it, but you can't add tests for it until you change it.
Yes, so it's that's this a paradox.
Yeah, it's this apparent catch-22. But luckily, it's not really a catch-22 because you can get past it. And I use the Sprout method technique and the Sprout class technique from that book to kind of get past it. Do you ever use those techniques?
Yeah, and the wrap method also is useful. When you really don't have time and you really need to do that, there are actually these techniques are here to create a bubble of safety for you. So existing code you need to change, it's super hard. You cannot put that into test, and you really don't have time to put that into test. So last resort, create your new code, put that somewhere else, completely unrelated, so it's easy to test it, and do a minimal insertion into the existing code. So you are minimizing the changes you are doing in the untested existing code. That's the whole rationale behind that. So yeah, these are like last resort technique. I definitely did use them when you really have to do your change and you really don't have time to do the test.
Interesting. I have a slightly different twist on it. I use those techniques as a first resort. So if I come across a piece of code where, like, let's say there's this method that's 100 lines long, it's just a monster, and you can't write a test for the method because it takes like 8 arguments and you don't know even what the method is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So I will, like, out of that 100 line method, I'll take like 5 lines and move those 5 lines into their own method. Maybe even I'll create a whole new class that just houses a new method with those 5 lines. And I can write a test for that 5-line thing because it's so small and has such few dependencies. And then I'll modify the original method to call my new tiny method. And that is a viable technique because it's so minimally invasive. There is a risk of introducing a regression because you did change something without testing it. I did pull those 5 lines out of that 100 line method, so it's possible that I screwed something up, but fortunately it's unlikely because the scope of my change was so small. And then once I have that test added, again, that's the beachhead that I've established, I can bit by bit move little pieces of that 100 line method over to my new method. So I like that technique. I use that. I don't know if I'm right or wrong to do this, but that's a tool in my toolbox that I often reach for first.
Oh yeah, no. So what you're describing is extract method. Yeah, it's you even have code, like text editor who provide you with this automated refactoring. It depends on your language, I think. The For example, in JavaScript, you cannot really do that safely, but in TypeScript or Java, for example, it's totally doable. It's totally safe to automate that kind of refactoring, extracting method, and it's definitely super useful when you're refactoring a big code like that. Yeah, definitely do that. The technique Michael Feathers recommends, I would like to say, is so try to put your existing code into test by breaking the problematic dependencies of it. And there is a whole catalog of situations you can run into and then what to do in such scenario. And then refactor that code that is no tested and then do your change. But that can take a very long time. So extracting progressively, I think it's a good compromise actually what you're doing. The only thing, as you said, you effectively don't test the original function, but it's still a small refactoring, like in terms of risk. So I think it's okay. There is another technique also. If you manage to get your function into a test, you remember the snapshot test I was mentioning at the beginning, saying that usually they are bad tests. Actually, this is a scenario where they can be really useful. Because these kind of tests are taking a snapshot of the existing behavior and then comparing the new behavior with the existing behavior, and they will fail if there is any change. But when you are just refactoring this big function, that's exactly what you want to know. So if you manage to get a snapshot of what your function is doing under a different context, this can be quite like fast to get. And when you have that, then you can safely go and extract things and move things around, etc., in your function, because if you do any mistake, you will have a test that will tell you the output has changed.
Yeah, and I like to use yet another technique from that. But this book is really a gold mine. I'll say the
Yes.
name of it again. It's Working Effectively with Legacy Code by Michael Feathers. Super helpful. I got it like so many years ago, and it was, if nothing else, it was like psychologically helpful for me to know that other people dealt with these same super frustrating legacy code issues. But the technique that I enjoy from it is you mentioned the term already, characterization testing. So, and by the way, it's super interesting to learn like your interpretation and applications of these different techniques, which are not exactly the same as mine the whole time. Because I don't know if my applications of these techniques are quite the way the author intended them. You know, I don't know if I'm interpreting the same or using them the same. I'm sure that I'm not. But anyway, when I do characterization testing, I will write a test for a method, and I will say, let's say the method returned a string, I'll just expect it to return ASDF. Then obviously that method's not going to return ASDF, it'll return something else. And so then I'll update my test. Oh, it returned 46. I'll change my test to say 46. Now my test passes. I don't understand what it does still, but now I have one test for this. And I'll continue to poke at it from all different directions until maybe I have 10 tests for that method. And then once I get to that point, usually like the picture bit by bit becomes sufficiently clear that I can say, okay, I can kind of see what this is doing. I'll rename this variable here, move these lines around here, and before I know it, the method is refactored into something that actually makes sense.
Yes. Well, this is exactly how it's described. So yes, this is characterization testing. The only difference with the snapshot testing, for example, you have in JavaScript is that or approval testing It's there is approvaltest.com providing that kind of tooling for many languages. And the only difference is that they automate the, you write a silly expected value, it fails, it gives you the actual value, you copy paste the actual value in the expected. So this back and forth is automated for you. You will say that it should match the snapshot, for example. The first time it runs, it will take the output and put that in a file, and that's your snapshot. And the next time it will compare it to your existing snapshot. But these are like big words on something that you already do manually. So there is no difference. It's just intimidating, but it's you already know how to do it. So yeah, it's exactly that.
Yeah, super useful technique. Well, Nicholas, I think you and I could probably talk for about 8 more hours or even longer probably on this topic, because there really is so much to say, but unfortunately we have limited time. So where can people find you online, and where can they go to learn more stuff about testing legacy code or any other resources you want to share, but especially where can they find you?
Yeah, that's a vast topic. The easiest way for people to read what I'm talking about is on understandlegacycode.com. So this is a blog where I put every week all of the contents, the knowledge I have, the tips, the tricks, the books, resources, and all of that. There is even a newsletter. People can register if they want to get that in their inbox. That's the main point of contact, I would say. I will also want to say that there is a community, so you're not alone. Many people across the globe are dealing with legacy code, and some people actually love that. So there is a community called legacycode.rocks. It's a podcast and a Slack community. I'm part of it, so if you're curious, just go check, listen to the podcast, join us on Slack, and we'll be really happy to discuss with you.
Yeah, these people have some kind of psychological disorder where they enjoy working with legacy code.
Yeah, it's a bit like, you know, you have makers, people really enjoy make things, and they define themselves as menders. People really like to go in and maintain old code base just like it's an old building and restore it, make it work. And it's interesting because, you know, this old code base, if you have to maintain it, it suddenly has value. And sometimes it's the code that is paying your salary. So, yeah, it's a valuable code that you're just afraid to change. And this is actually my definition of legacy code, valuable code you're afraid to change. Learning to deal with that is an important skill.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you say that. I have tried to put some words to the definition of bad code. Not even just legacy code, just like what is bad code? And the definition I came up with was something like code that is expensive or risky to change, which is, it's interesting because that's basically the same thing that you said about legacy code. It's code that, what did you say, code that you're afraid to change?
Yeah, valuable code that you're afraid to change. There is a subjective aspect to it because knowledge is part of it. There is an importance of knowledge and knowledge loss. If you know how the code base behaves and work, it's less scary to do modifications on it. But when you have lost that knowledge, or when you don't have that knowledge, it's even harder. So it's kind of subjective. Yeah,
that's very true. Okay, well, this has been super, super helpful. I've had a lot of fun talking about legacy code. This has been hopefully educational for the listener. I'm sure it was. It's been educational for me. Nicholas, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It was really fun.